You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report says Wisconsin needs to attract more than 250,000 people to the state over the next 20 years just to maintain its workforce. We'll learn more on how it'll affect our economy coming up.
First, students are getting back into the swing of things on university campuses around the state. That means catching up, maybe some parties, and for some students, high-risk drinking.
One UW campus is working to curb binge and high-risk drinking by going door-to-door at the homes of off-campus students.
Sandy Scott joins us now. She's the Dean of Students at UW-Stout, where they just rolled out this door-to-door program. Sandy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, can you tell me where the idea for this program going door to door came from?
Sure. We have an alcohol and drug coalition that meets several times throughout the year, just sort of always focused on ways we can continue to educate students around responsible alcohol and drug use. And we were talking about how we could continue to reach the off-campus population, especially the 21-plus population. It's much easier when they're on campus and are sort of a confined group. And in part of that conversation, I remembered a number of years ago, I had gone to a summit at the University of Minnesota where they talked about city council members who had joined together with local law enforcement to go door-to-door in some neighborhoods of the university to welcome students back and talk more about, there it was, safety information and who their city council member was. So I remembered that concept and proposed it to some members of our coalition here as a way that the university could engage with that population.
And who is it who's going door-to-door knocking on off-campus student housing?
It's faculty and staff members who volunteered their time to do that. The core group was made up of members of the Dean of Students staff, our alcohol and drug coordinator who works in our counseling center, and then we just put the call out for other volunteers, and a number of folks rose to the occasion and said they'd be more than happy to interact with our off-campus students and help with this initiative.
And my first thought was, it's startling when someone comes to your door. How is this, do you think, going over with students who are going to have, if they answer the door, maybe a difficult or at least a thoughtful conversation that they didn't expect?
Yeah, initially, I do think students were surprised, especially we broke it out over 2 days. Although word had spread by day two, and we actually had a number of students who said, oh, yeah, I was waiting for you. I heard you might be coming. The first day, of course, there were some students who were surprised. But once we identified ourselves and indicated that we were there to welcome them back, that was our first order of business. And then we walked through the bag of information and three key points that we wanted to hit on with every student. By the end of the conversation, students were really appreciative. We received a number of comments of, wow, I didn't. I'm surprised the university cared about us off-campus students. And we're like, we absolutely care and want you to know you have access to resources, even when you live off-campus. So they responded very, very well.
So these information packets, what's in them?
There's quite a bit of information. In addition to the information, which I can walk through in just a minute, we also had some local establishments, businesses, who gave some freebies, handy wipes, bottles of water, things like that. So there were also just some giveaways in there for students. But in terms of information, it contained a number of items. Some of the most popular, the ones we highlighted, one was really about social hosting, and if particular student or group of students was going to choose to host, how they could be responsible hosts. We had information related to also should they choose again to be a social host, what they could do before and after the party to be a good neighbor. And we included information on the Menominee ordinances and what students might see as potential fines if the party were to get out of hand, as well as what might be the consequences they might face on campus. One of the most popular pieces of information in there was a card that we called the birthday crawl, and it was ways that students could celebrate their 21st birthday in a smart and healthy way, and it contained or listed a number of freebies that they could get from restaurants and other establishments items for free on their 21st birthday. We actually received a lot of comments about that. We've actually had a couple students stop by and who actually live on campus and ask if they could have one of those too, since students are always interested in free food. We had information on how to watch your blood alcohol content for men and for women, because that does vary. Other information related to voter registration, student health services and counseling services on campus, and information for how off-campus students could access those services. So it was a pretty big bag full of information for them.
We're talking with Sandy Scott right now, Dean of Students at UW-Stout, talking about UW-Stout's new door-to-door program working to educate off-campus students about the dangers of high-risk drinking. And Sandy, you mentioned these three key points that you want to make sure these students come away with. What are those points?
The first one for us was really that if they are going to choose to drink, and we know that a number of our students, both on and off campus, choose not to drink, and that's certainly, that number actually is increasing for us every year. But if they are going to choose to drink, that they do so in a way that really avoids the high-risk behaviors like drinking and driving, drinking to the point of incapacitation, leaving an incapacitated person alone, being a responsible social host. So really avoiding the high-risk drinking behaviors. The second key point was if there's a fellow Blue Devil who needs help or assistance, that we hope that what they'll do is step up. We ask that our students not be in a bystander, but instead that they do intervene to help a Blue Devil in need. And the third point was that here at UW-Stout, Blue Devils take care of each other, and that is what the university expects them to do.
And students have been receptive to this. Was anyone not happy about having this conversation?
We know that there were a few places where students didn't open their door or come out and talk to us, and that's totally their choice. But that was actually fairly rare, and we really didn't have a single situation where students said, don't bother us or don't come back again. Students were really pretty receptive and seemed open to the fact that a university staff member cared enough to spend the time contacting them and talking with them.
Now, I know that UW-Stout has had a handful of alcohol-related deaths in the recent past. Do you think that this effort is something that will make a difference in that, and that students are ready to hear, maybe because there's also awareness of what can be very severe consequences to high-risk drinking?
Yeah, we hope so. I don't think there is one magic answer. I think our coalition, we talk all the time about in order to really work hard to make sure that those deaths and injuries don't happen, it's a constant approach, a three-pronged approach of engagement, education, and enforcement. And so this particular Knock and Talk initiative really capitalized both the engagement and the education piece. And so our goal is that we'll continue to engage in all three of those areas in an effort to hopefully make a difference and to not have additional student deaths. We know that ultimately student responsibility is what comes into play, and student choices that they make and how responsible they are in their choice to drink. And we want to do our part. Ultimately, we know that we are just one, we're one player, but boy, we're an incredibly important player in helping students make those good choices.
And you said students love that card about 20 things to do that don't involve alcohol for your birthday. Is there something there, do you think, teaching students about how to have fun without alcohol being the focal point?
I do think that's it. And normalizing behaviors that are about having fun without alcohol is an important piece of that. So some of the promotional materials that we do throughout the year really normalize that. And our data shows this, that the vast majority of students don't engage in high-risk drinking behavior, that the vast majority of our students do drink responsibly. It's that percentage that don't, of course, that get the attention, and unfortunately when really tragic and bad things can happen. But I think normalizing for students that it's okay to have fun without alcohol is a really important part of the role that we have.
Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was Sandy Scott, Dean of Students at UW-Stout, and she joined us to talk about a new program there going door-to-door to combat binge drinking.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says that the sexist language targeting Hillary Clinton throughout the election probably won't go away, and it's likely to get worse if she's elected to the presidency.
First, while Wisconsin is recovering from the Great Recession and has been rebounding somewhat steadily in terms of job growth, the state is not fully out of the woods yet, especially with some challenges facing Wisconsin over the next few decades.
A new report from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance says that for the state's long-term economic health, at least 300,000 people need to migrate to the state to fill available jobs and replace an aging workforce and a shrinking tax base.
Joining us now to talk about the report is Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Dale, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here this afternoon.
Let's start off with that number, about 300,000 people that we need here in Wisconsin over the next couple of decades. Why 300,000?
Well, and that's a net number. That takes into account that we're going to have some people leaving, and so we have to have really more than that coming here. The reason is, the baby boomers are in the process now of retiring, and generally we have relatively low birth rates in Wisconsin compared to most parts of the country. And so we're going to begin losing population and, in fact, losing workforce because of those demographic challenges. And the only way really that we're going to be able to fix that and to continue to have a stable workforce is to, on net, import about 300,000 new workers over the next 20 or 30 years.
A big part of your new report, though, suggests that for the last handful of years, we've had a net decline, more people leaving than coming in.
Yeah, the 300,000 number comes from a report we did a couple years ago looking at these big demographic challenges, and this is sort of an update to that and saying, okay, so where are we in terms of net migration? And actually, we've been losing people on net since about 2005. 2014, the last year that we have data, we lost on net about 10,000 people. Now, for a state our size, those aren't big numbers, but we're moving in the wrong direction, and given the needs that we have over the next 20 years, effectively we have to begin pretty quickly to turn this around and turn it around in a fairly big way, that's just to maintain the workforce that we have, not even looking at a growing workforce.
Now, one thing that seems contradictory, the report says when it comes to people just leaving the state, actually people in Wisconsin tend to stay in Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yeah, that confirms some studies that we did in the past. In terms of when you look at the rates that people leave the state, only three states have lower rates. So it's not, overall, it's not an issue of Wisconsinites leaving. It's more an issue of we have a very low rate of in-migration of people coming here. And weather, climate has obviously something to do with that. People aren't moving to cold weather states. They're moving south. They're moving west. And so we have to find other ways, to make Wisconsin attractive to people that are in the workforce.
Get to that in just a minute, but let's talk about the damage here. If we don't solve this, if we keep having, even if we're just breaking even, maybe even having a small gain as opposed to this slow loss of people, what is the damage to the state's economy if we're not getting close to that 300,000 figure of people we want in the next couple decades?
Well, really, there's really a couple of big things that will probably work against each other to some degree. If we don't have a growing workforce or even, maintain the workforce that we have, growing businesses in the state aren't going to expand here because they won't be able to find the workers, and they'll think about expanding, in other places where they can find the workers. And new businesses from other states or businesses from other states that are looking to expand their workforce aren't going to consider Wisconsin again because they're not going to be able to find the workers. The good news to some degree, and the good news, it's the good news for individual workers. One of the things that this this whole demographic change should do is put pressure on wages. One of the things we found is Wisconsin's average wages tend to be 10-12% below the U.S. average. If the workforce is stagnant or declining to some degree, we're going to have worker shortages, and that will push up wages. So for the workers that are here, it should be some good news in terms of their pocketbook.
But overall, the state might be losing tax revenue by not having all those people and jobs in place.
In terms of state and local government, yes, it'll be it'll be declining or stagnant tax revenues, and that can become a sort of a cyclical problem, something that feeds on itself, because you need quality schools, you need infrastructure, you need all of those things that governments provide to attract people. But if you don't have the tax revenues to fund those, those kinds of things can sort of feed on themselves.
Talking to Dale Knapp from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, according to a new report from that group, Wisconsin needs people, a good number of them, 300,000 of them over the next 20 years or so. And if we don't get those people, and we're not, people aren't moving to Wisconsin in particularly great numbers, it will be a drag on the economy. Dale, how do we get more people to come to Wisconsin? What's the next step to try to solve this?
Well, as I mentioned, people are moving, south and west, and so we can't do much about the weather here. But, again, one of the things this piece of research and others have found is that you can attract those new families with, quality schools, with low-crime communities, with, basically the quality of life type thing. So making sure our public schools are still, some of the best in the country, making sure we have, a good park system, the roads are in good shape, all of those things, a good, high-quality university system, those things are all attractive to families. The piece that's challenging is, obviously people don't necessarily like paying taxes, and those all cost tax dollars. So it's a matter of trying to maintain it and keep those at high levels, and keeping the tax burden at a reasonable place. So I don't envy policymakers having to walk that fine line.
Right, there's the tricky bit, because the things you just listed, higher education, schools, state wildlife areas, a lot of news stories involving those, you could search for those, and budget cuts, that's going to come up a lot over the last bunch of years. How do we know if policymakers are cutting it too close on walking that line?
Well, I think that's really, it's hard to say. I mean, it's not something that you can normally, that you generally see in the short run. You tend to look back and say, oh, maybe we did a little bit too much or not enough in that area. The migration numbers will tell us something. If we're maintaining things and improving our schools more than other states, the migration numbers, over the next 5-10 years will begin to turn around. It's something that we're not, it's going to be really difficult in the very short term to say what we're doing is right or what we're doing is wrong.
I want to get into one other part of your report. You tried to break down who was leaving by age and income category and who was coming in or not coming in. What kind of things did you find?
Well, one of the things you see here and actually nationally is young people tend to move the most. Obviously they're going to college, they're going to start their careers, all of those. So they're moving the most, and generally the movement declines as you age for the most part. We're basically, we move less than the nation in all of those age groups. The one area that we really differ, one area that we really have a challenge is high-income retirees. It's one of the areas that really stands out, that we're losing a fair number of 65 and older with high incomes. In fact, we're beginning to lose them at the 55 to 60 age as well. And that doesn't help. I mean, that's not going to be a, keeping those people is not going to be a solution for the workforce necessarily, because you know they may work part time, but they're generally not going to be working. But they're taking with them a fair amount of capital that can be used for new business startups. You know, invest in the state. You know, and tax revenue for the state. So that's the one area that I think that we have to do better at in terms of keeping people here. It's the challenge there, again, is the weather. And one of the things we point out, we're not sure if it's weather that's driving them or income taxes. One of the things we find is income taxes matter to some degree. And, you know, those high-income people are tending to go to Florida where there's no income tax. And so, you know, it's a question of are they leaving because of the income tax and then going to, you know, Florida, going to a warm weather state, or are they going because of the weather? And then there's really nothing that we can do about that.
As we wrap up, Dale, you've got this report out. What are you hoping people do with it?
Well, we're hoping that people, that legislators, that public officials, state leaders, really begin to think long term. This is something we can't change overnight, but it's going to affect the state, and we need to be thinking all of the policies that we're putting in place at the state level, at the local level, at the business level, are going to affect what we look like 20 years from now. And hopefully, you know, we can figure out a way to turn this around, at least maintain our workforce, maintain, you know, the quality of life that we have here.
Dale, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank
That's
you.
Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He joined us to talk about their newest report titled Wisconsin's Migration Challenge, about the need, they say, to attract more people to the state to guarantee Wisconsin's future economic success.
Coming up, our guest says there's been a lot of ugly language directed at Hillary Clinton during the election campaign, and she predicts a lot of sexist criticism if Clinton is elected. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA with part 2 of a series on the Latino influence on hip-hop music. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, our next segment will include some language that parents may not find suitable for young children, or some listeners may find offensive. When Hillary Clinton announced her intention to run for president in 2015, no one was particularly surprised at the news.
There's also been a lot of heated partisan language directed at Clinton. Again, not surprising, given a very polarized country. But our next guest says that a lot of the language directed at Clinton goes beyond everyday political rhetoric. She points toward angry and sexist attacks, including frequent instances of people calling Clinton a bitch and a lot of other words we can't say on the radio.
And our guest says that sexist language won't go away in the event that Hillary Clinton becomes our next president. Michelle Cottle joins us now. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. She recently wrote a piece called The Era of the Bitch is Coming. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob.
So, Michelle, people will say sometimes, hey, if you go into politics, you're going to get a lot of harsh language directed at you. Is this something that's above and beyond the norm?
Well, I don't know that it's above and beyond the norm, but it is a very particular kind of harsh language. You know, in a very similar way that Barack Obama got attacked and looked at through the prism of race, this is a lot of what will happen if we see a Hillary Clinton presidency. She'll be attacked for lots of reasons, but in a lot of instances, it's going to have a sexist angle to it, or an edge for it.
Can you talk about some of the things we're seeing in the campaign that falls into that category?
Well, one thing a lot of people I talked to mentioned was just how surprised they were about the Republican convention and a lot of the T-shirts and buttons you're seeing, you know, the pictures of Trump on a motorcycle with wearing a T-shirt that said, if you can read this, the bitch fell off, or people talking at rallies. There was that teenager, and he wasn't even a teenager. He was a tween little boy who was chanting, take the bitch down. I mean, you're seeing a lot of these things. If you get online, of course, then there's the whole menopausal crazy bitch meme, which is actually, I've talked to other female leaders who say this is actually pretty common. Menopausal bitch is a very, you know, very straightforward way to dismiss someone and kind of denigrate them. So you see a lot of these things, plus stuff that's even nastier that we won't need to go into. But if you think of a foul part of the female vulgarity referring to the female anatomy, Clinton has been called that in recent weeks.
And you write that this will not get better if Clinton is elected. It's probably going to get worse. And you go to Australia for some precedent. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, Julia Gillard was the first female prime minister of Australia. And I've spoken with her because she actually experienced something very similar where she was surprised at how, after she took office, she kind of thought perhaps her gender would be an issue initially and then it would fade away. She actually found that the longer she stayed in office and the more difficult issues she had to tackle, the more that the sexist rhetoric and misogynistic attacks cropped up. Because it's often not even people who are really upset about sexism or gender anxiety. That's just a useful way to automatically dismiss someone's leadership or judgment or argument. So as she tackled tougher political issues, she found herself under attack more often from a sexist perspective.
Now, people are looking at high-profile women in politics, you know, Sarah Palin, a vice presidential candidate, now Hillary Clinton, at the top of a major party ticket as a big sign of progress that women can be at this point. But with the language you're talking about, some of the response you're talking about, do you see it as a huge accomplishment given the reaction, the backlash?
Yes. Weirdly, that's part of the whole thing. You kind of have to go through this. I mean, this is hurtful and upsetting, and as we've seen with Obama, it can take you back a few steps in terms of racial, you know, the public rhetoric on race and racial relations, and the public rhetoric on gender will certainly be an issue, but if you talk to people who study this or who've been through it, it's always the trailblazers who have to be willing to take those hits, and when people's traditional view of things is threatened, the impulse to lash out is strong. But then it becomes less and less exotic and more acceptable or comfortable, and eventually it's not a big deal anymore. So while it's upsetting and while Clinton, if she winds up winning, will take an enormous amount of grief over this, she will kind of be clearing the path for the next woman.
Talking to Michelle Cottle. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic, talking about sexism, misogyny. She says targeting Hillary Clinton this race, she says it will get worse, not better for a while, at least if she is elected Hillary Clinton is elected president in a couple of months. Michelle, I wonder if there's a phenomenon, you kind of allude to this in your piece, when, you know, there's a woman starring in an action movie, if it fails, people say, oh, okay, people don't want to see women in action movies. There's such a small sample to draw from. You write that a woman who's prominent in politics, or an African-American prominent in politics for that matter, if they fail, it's seen as a reflection on everybody, where a white guy in politics, there's not that similar kind of standard.
Exactly. When you are new, when you are different from the norm that people are accustomed to, you carry a lot more responsibility. You know, again, going back with President Obama, people were very nervous about, you know, would, if he had failures, would it be seen as a black president's failure? Well, the same is situation is here with women. When women are in roles that they don't normally hold, and a lot of the academics and politicians I talked to pointed to even women in business, you know, like Marissa Mayer and folks like that, Carly Fiorina, who were really high-profile female executives who flamed out, and it became this huge deal. And a lot of people were asking, well, maybe, you know, maybe they didn't have the right culture or the right leadership or whatever, and they point out that nobody asks that of men. Nobody says, well, George W. Bush was a terrible president because he was a guy. So it does carry an extra little bit of weight because it's new and unusual.
Now, this is a very different campaign, not only because we have the first female major party presidential candidate, but because we have Donald Trump as the other major party political candidate, a candidate who, the way he talks, if you're a supporter, you say he has a refreshing lack of political correctness. If you're not, you say he has very loaded language about women. How do you see that playing out in this election?
I see a lot of white-knuckling by his staff during the debates. I mean, some people, his supporters that you talk to, are like, well, he insults everybody, to be fair. You know, it doesn't matter if you're male, female, black, Hispanic. He's insulting to everybody, which on some level is true. But if he starts attacking Hillary in a way that people find particularly sexist and offensive, the Republican Party has already been really fighting this idea that it is an anti-woman party, and that cannot help its cause. I mean, he has a base for whom the more offensive he is, the better, but you can't win the presidency with a small base vote. You have to expand it, and that's going to make his staff a bit nervous until they see if he's going to be able to keep it under control when the debates are on or when the spotlight is really focused.
Now, half the people roughly in the United States are women, and it's really hard to generalize about such a thing as a woman voter. There are women in both parties, in neither party, in the Tea Party, wherever you want to name it. But how do you see this playing out for women voters, in quotes, seeing the first woman running as a major party presidential candidate?
You know, I've talked to conservative Republican activist women who will admit that on some level they get there's a bit of pride there. Now, Clinton is also unusual because she's so controversial in and of herself, and the degree to which that is a result of her being a female politician, we can debate all day long. In fact, my Atlantic colleague Peter Beinart has a piece out in this issue about how people perceive female leaders and the kind of just unspoken, below the surface, even unconscious sexism that plays into a lot of that, and that gets people really fired up. People go crazy when they suggest, you know, you suggest that people still hold biases against female leaders. But all of the studies out there say it's true, so it's hard to separate that from just kind of the weird Clinton inflammatory image they have. I mean, so it's an interesting from that perspective as well, because Hillary and Bill both kind of generate such strong feelings among the Republican base that some people just go crazy about it. But I have talked to, you know, that's a long way of saying I've talked to some Republican women who say they're going to vote for her because in part they're disturbed by Trump, and because, you know, that said, she is a reasonably middle-of-the-road Democrat who they're kind of proud of the fact that this will happen.
We're talking to Michelle Cottle. She's a contributing editor to The Atlantic, looking at what she says is a lot of public sexism, misogyny surrounding Hillary Clinton's campaign for president.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of the language of this campaign season so far? And even if you don't like Hillary Clinton, do you think it's appropriate that she has been called a series of words that are offensive, especially to women? And if there are any female lawmakers listening, have you faced this kind of language as you've launched campaigns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And a word of warning, some language that will be used during this interview may not be suitable for young children, and some people may find it offensive.
We're continuing our conversation with Michelle Cottle from The Atlantic. She says there's been a lot of sexist language directed at Hillary Clinton in the election campaign, and she says things will get worse, probably, if Clinton ends up winning.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of the language that's been directed at Hillary Clinton? Do you think it's any worse than what some people have used to describe her challenger, Donald Trump? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now with Mark on the line in West Bend. Mark, hi.
Hi. Interesting topic, but I felt the need to chime in because I'm very familiar with the T-shirt. If you can read this, the Bix fell off. I don't know if that was just an example of a of something typically worn by a male, and it's obviously using a derogatory term towards a female, but it's got absolutely nothing to do with Hillary Clinton. It's been a popular T-shirt among bikers and riders, typically of a particular brand of motorcycle, and it's kind of a play on the, you know, if you can read this, you're following too closely, mm-hmm. Concept, but in the case of a motorcycle with a pillion passenger on the back, if you can read the back of his T-shirt,
right.
He obviously fell off. It's got nothing to do with Hillary Clinton.
Mark, thanks for the call, but as I understand it, there are versions of this T-shirt with a picture of Donald Trump as the man on the motorcycle and Hillary Clinton falling off the motorcycle with that slogan. Do I have that right, Michelle?
Yeah, it's very specifically targeted, Hillary, and I understand. I am well aware that T-shirt has been around forever, but this is very particular targeting Hillary as the bitch in question.
And that's not the only one of those shirts. There are other examples you give in your piece.
Oh, sure. Trump versus Trump, all these buttons. You know, if you want to get even nastier, you know, what is it? It's like, don't be a, you know, what is it? Don't be a, vote for Trump. I mean, they've called her the C word. There's all, you know, like, don't vote for a bitch. Life's a bitch. Don't vote for one. There's a lot of very, just adorable plays on words out there if you want to go shopping.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Bob on the line in Fitchburg. Bob, hi.
Hello. I wish we would look at the rest of the world and the number of female leaders in the other countries of this world, civilized countries, that are very successful, that are looked up to. And we are looking at ourselves. We're not looking at the reality of the world.
Bob, thanks for the call. And Michelle, I know you'd looked at the example for Australia, which didn't provide a much more positive outlook there. And I don't know if you surveyed other countries with female leaders. Is anybody else doing better on this?
Well, a lot of places have had female leaders. One of the things that people note is that female leaders tend to pop up more in parliamentary systems because you're looking at party voting, like in Britain, for example, or Australia. You have party voting for the leader as opposed to a wide, broad, popular vote. And so it's a little bit easier because you're dealing with party activists and party elites or party leaders, and you don't have a lot of the issues at play about traditional views on leadership and things like that. So it's not an exact one apples to apples kind of thing when you're looking at different kinds of systems. But he is correct. We are behind in this particular regard.
Bob, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Michelle Cottle from The Atlantic. She says sexist language, misogynistic language directed to Hillary Clinton, only going to get worse if she ends up being elected president. If any women out there listening are interested to know what you think about what you've heard in the campaign about language related to a woman running for office, if you've run for office as a woman yourself, very interested to hear what your experience was like. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff is on the line next in Madison. Jeff, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've been going back and forth with my parents. I'm 50 and they're 73 and 74. I've been absolutely shocked at the tendency for not just my two parents, but everyone I talk to amongst their friends. It's almost solely, on that leading edge of the baby boom seems to go for the jugular with personal issues and not political issues. And, you know, I keep trying to drag them back to we need to look at conservative versus liberal and what are the positions. And they want to go for, oh, my gosh, you know, this conspiracy or that conspiracy. I've just been shocked at how this older set of voters tends to gravitate towards personal things rather than, you know, the more political. It just...
Interesting,
my own parents,
Jeff.
They're both college educated, and they just won't leave the personal stuff alone.
Interesting. And Michelle, do you see generational differences here?
Well, with presidential races in particular, the joke is that people don't vote for a politician; they vote for a boyfriend, or in this case, a girlfriend. Americans tend to really look at personality and how a presidential candidate makes them feel. And this is one of the problems that Hillary Clinton has always had. She is not a terribly likable candidate in terms of that whole hail fellow well met, want to have a beer with her, comfortable sharing. You know, she's not her husband. She's not George W. Bush, who had a nickname for everybody. And so you combine that with this, all of these personal stories about scandals and, you know, not being trustworthy. And one of the reasons that people are suspicious of her is she's really closed off. You know, we saw that with this health thing this week. And I don't know that that is necessarily a generational thing. It's just that people who are older have been around longer. And so remember every single Clinton scandal that was just exhausting during the 90s, and they've been paying attention, and they kind of remember a time when politics wasn't quite so down in the mud. So you do have this real problem of just Clinton's lack of personal charisma or whatever, combined with all of these scandals, make her a tough sell.
Now, how do we people tease out, you know, there are differences with Hillary Clinton, and there are valid political differences. Republicans have found them. Democrats have found them from maybe a double standard where they're imposing a personality standard on a woman running for office that they wouldn't on a man running for office.
Well, I think that's one of the things that people find really difficult, even who study this for a long time. And this is why this article that my colleague Peter Beinart wrote is about all of these studies where they do these blind tests, like you tell people this candidate for office is a woman and you give them this criteria and they hate her, but if she's a man, it's okay. I mean, it's really almost impossible for people to separate out those really deeply held cultural biases about, you know, if it's a man, he's assertive and confident. If it's a woman, she's pushy and a bitch. People laugh when you talk about that, but it's true. It's still true in a lot of cases. And I think it's even more true as you go back. And here is, I think, where you have to look at probably generational issues, because I think that's getting less true, but you're still dealing with a lot of those kind of ingrained biases that people sometimes are not even aware of.
Linda on Facebook wrote, it's going to get ugly just as it got ugly for Obama because he's not a white male. Linda writes, I guess the upside, if there is one, is that it makes us realize how far we have to go for gender and racial equality. So people have talked about, well, the election of President Obama didn't mean we're in a post-racial society. The possible election of Hillary Clinton wouldn't mean we're in a post-gender society either.
Exactly. And, you know, talking with Julia Gillard, she was talking about how there are a lot of issues with gender parity and treatment of women that are still yet to be dealt with in the U.S. You know, issues like pay equality, paid child care, a lot of these so-called women's issues that Hillary being president would bring to the fore, just like Obama being president brought a lot of racial issues to the fore. And that's good because they need to be dealt with. Everybody just needs to be prepared for when stuff like that gets brought forward. It gets ugly. It is never, I mean, these problems still exist because they're tough and they're complicated and people are touchy about them. So they get really ugly. But yes, I think for a lot of this, it still needs to be tackled, and it's good for people to talk about it. It's always, you know, it's good to have this stuff aired.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much. It's been great.
We're talking to Michelle Cottle, contributing editor at The Atlantic, talking about sexist language in the political campaign. You can find more on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.